And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast on a Thursday morning. We are thrilled to be joined all the way from beautiful Salt Lake City, Utah, by the radio voice of the Utah Jazz on the verge of their first playoff win since 2009-10 and the founder of the robust Locked On Podcast Network, which is covering 29 of 30 NBA teams, and of course the 30th is the Brooklyn Nets. David Locke, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited. As you know well now with your little daughter, my 12-year-old daughter listens to every episode, is a huge fan of The Low Post, and I think I might be cool for the first time ever as a dad that I'm on The Low Post podcast. So this is good for me.
I don't know your daughter. I hope she's all right. You know, I hope she's doing all right in school. Is everything okay?
She's great. I think she plans to try to track you down at some point in time. You know, that there'll be the young and up and comer that's going to come get you when you're, you know, 20 years into the business, and that's her plan, I think.
I'm sure by then I will be doing something else and not this. Let's start with
back to crime reporting for Zach.
Yeah, let's start with a game. Ready?
All right, I'm ready.
The Jazz have not won a playoff series since 2010. Can you name the seven members of the 2009-10 Utah Jazz who played at least 1 minute in the NBA this season?
On that team, well, I should because I called those games.
I know it might be too easy. The harder question might be the eight who did not, but go for it.
So Kyle Korver was on that team and played.
Yes.
Wesley Matthews was on that team and played.
Yes.
Darren Williams was on that team and played.
Yes.
Ronnie Price played on that team.
Ooh, I thought that might be the one you missed.
And got so that's four.
That's
how many
four.
More? I have three more to go.
You got three more to go.
Ronnie Brewer's out of the league. Carlos Boozer's out of the league. Mehmet Okur's coaching in the league. They're probably young players that were developing. I'm stymied. Andre Kirilenko.
Well, first of all, you're missing the present day best player of all of them.
Oh, Gordon Hayward was on that team.
No,
he was not. No. Present day best player of all of them. Former Jazz player, best player of all of them. No longer on our roster.
Backup back then.
You got me.
Paul Millsap.
Oh, yeah, of course. Jeez, that's ridiculous. Okay.
Two more to go.
I don't have them. I'm not even trying to Google. I'm not even trying to do the basketball reference Google search right now.
Sharp shooting wing player who came directly out of high school, I believe.
CJ Miles.
Yes.
All-time favorites.
Backup center still in the league playing for the NBA's most dysfunctional franchise.
Costa Koufos?
Yes. 7 out of 7. The other
took me a little bit, though.
The other names are almost more interesting. The members is Sundiata Gaines. Oh my god, that was so fun, the Sundiata Gaines experience. AK-47. Boozer. You mentioned Brewer and Memo you mentioned, and so it's been a long time. So you're the Jet.
Those teams were 2 years before their time. Like, can you imagine Memo as a stretch five now? With Boozer passing out of the post, with Kyle Korver and Wesley Matthews. Oh, my gosh.
It's an eclectic group of guys in terms of their journeys to the NBA and their careers since then, actually. But that's 7 years ago. Right now, the Jazz are up 3-2 over the Clippers. Coming home for Game 6 tomorrow. You're about to go to practice shortly after this podcast. How confident are you that they're wrapping this at home?
You know, the score of this series is tied.
It's zero. I know. I couldn't believe that when I looked it up. I mean, it feels like it's been that close, but it's fun that it's exactly plus minus zero.
So that makes me not particularly confident. I do think that obviously playing at home matters. The Jazz have always been great at home. The arena was back to NBA Finals kind of energy. This team is connected to this fan base in a way that team we were just talking about didn't. Boozer never really connected. Darren never really connected. This group seems to have kind of touched a chord in the city in a manner that hasn't happened. So the crowd's more engaged. So that from that aspect, there's two matchup issues that the Jazz have right now that I think that the Clippers haven't quite answered all the way, though they may have begun to in game number five. One is Joe Johnson at the four has been unstoppable. Until game five, the Jazz offensive rating was about 94 when Joe Johnson was on the floor in game five. That's a big switch, and that may be Austin Rivers partially. And the Jazz haven't quite figured out the high pick and roll with Chris Paul, though the Clipper offensive rating was certainly down in game number five. which may have been, you know, there's a level of these series, Zach, where teams begin to get either physically or emotionally tired. And I think there was a little of that in five. 2 days off, I think six is going to be an unbelievable game.
I think Utah is going to win. Game five to me had the feel of Utah in that game, despite everything you just said about the low offensive rating with Joe at the four and all that. They had the feel of a team to me that, and I'm not at the games, so maybe I'm just misreading this, but they looked and played like a team that had figured out through 4.5 games or whatever, okay, we can beat these guys. We know what to do. We're confident. We're executing our system. We're moving the ball. We know we can get them in rotation. We know we can attack closeouts. We know we can get good shots and how to get good shots against them. And they missed so many good shots in the first quarter of that game. I don't know what they ended up shooting from three. It was okay by the end. I thought they were a better team by more than 4 or 5 points or whatever the final margin was. And just to me, the series has a feel of the Clippers are running out of stuff to try, and they're almost literally like running out of players. And obviously, Austin Rivers coming back helps them a lot. We can talk about that. I think DJ is getting visibly tired by the end of his stints, and they pushed him almost to 40 minutes on the dot in game five, which is as far as he can go. And I think by minute 8 and 9 of his, you know, first and third quarter stints, you can see him starting to wear. It just felt to me, sometimes I get this gut feel like one team has it figured out, and I think the Jazz have it figured out.
So I agree. The concept I agree with completely. I remember last year I texted Kevin Pelton at the end of the first half of game two of the Thunder Spurs series. And I remember I texted him. I said, am I crazy, or are the Thunder bigger, stronger, and faster at every position going to win the next four games? Like, you could just see it, even though the Spurs had that unbelievable shooting game one. I do hear where you're coming from. When you look at uncontested looks in this series, the Jazz had 32 in game one, only 28 in game two, only 20 in game three, and then they had 31 in game four, and they had 41 uncontested shots.
What'd they shoot on those?
22 of 41.
That's pretty good. That's good.
But see, this is what's interesting to me, Zach, of what you talked about, because I had the same feeling when I left the building that you had, and then when I went and started prepping for game six, I was like, wait a sec. They shot their season average from three. They shot 22 of 41 on uncontested looks. I think a little bit what happens is every time you see an NBA player as open as the Jazz were at the end of the first quarter when they missed 8 straight shots, and they were for portions of the third and fourth quarter, you assume it's going to go in. And that's just not the way it is. I'm not sure the Jazz do shoot a lot better than 22 of 41, 54% on open looks. And I'm not sure they shoot a great deal better than 36% from three in a game six knockout when there might be a little, you know, energy to them. So I'm not in that regard. I see all the same things you're saying. I'm not sure numerically I can back it up that they missed as many shots. I think we just may not have noticed all the ones that went in.
They don't strike me as a team that will get nervous. I don't know why that is. They're not an experienced team. This is their first time in the playoffs since Al Jefferson was there, and the first time for most of the players, most of the young players anyway. Obviously, they've got some old heads that are doing dynamite stuff in this series. Part of it is that, I mean, I've just been so impressed by Hayward in this series. You know, he obviously didn't play most of game four when he was sick, but he just, you know, he was a guy who, there were going to be a lot of eyes on him in the playoffs, both because of, you know, okay, now he's the guy. And the last time he was here, he was not the guy. How good is Gordon Hayward? I mean, is he a first option, a second option? Let's see how he does on the big stage. And number two, because, you know, he's going to get asked all the time. You know, if you lose this series, what does that mean for your future? Like, everything is wrapped up. And he has he's averaging like 22 a game, shooting almost 50% from three, 50% from the field, rebounding his ass off, playing great defense. Like, he just looks like he just looks to me like a guy who was ready for this and is confident and like ready to go to the next round. He just looks primed.
So one of the most enjoyable things in my career has been watching him since 2010 when we got him. You know, it really is on a personal level, watching him grow up from that kid to one of the more vivid memories I have with him, and I hope he doesn't mind me sharing this on this larger stage, but his rookie season, we were sitting on the bench before a game talking, and he had really not played at all. And he looked at me, he's like, I'm getting checks for this. Like, he was bothered. He was noticeably bothered by the fact that he was getting paid more money than probably either of his parents had ever made in a year to sit and do nothing. And that was the first insight into who this guy is. Like, he's not, he, he's, He's here to be something. The other was we went to lunch one time. I have to leave some names out of this. We went to lunch one off-season day before the season started. And in the middle of lunch, he just started just going nuts about all the articles written about everybody else that was in his draft class and everyone else around him that off-season. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, he is just enough bacon short of a BLT to be great. And that's what you have to be in this league to be great, is have that. I think he's one of the most miscast people due to every stereotype in the world. This is a ruthless competitor. He had to grow up. He grew up on our stage. We got the moment the other night where he rips the ball away from Chris Paul and drops a word that Ryan would have to beep out pretty substantially if producing this podcast at Chris Paul was a huge moment, because that's a different kid than the one Delonte West stuck the finger in his ear gave him a wet willy, and he didn't do anything about it.
I forgot about that.
And that evolution from the kid who kind of has burst out from and is, I will always tell you, he's a lot more Kobe Bryant than he is Opie from Leave It to Beaver.
And of course, he worked with Kobe over the summer, which he was not thrilled. He was not thrilled was made public.
Yes, thank you, Zach. It's so funny, is because you had me just to give inside scoop, as I knew that.
Of course you did. You worked for the team,
right? I had asked him whether I could use it. He said no. You used it. I like immediately read it. First sentence, I'm texting him like, I did not tell Zach Lowe. I promise I did not tell Zach Lowe.
I can't say how I heard. But here's, you know.
Can you back up that I did not tell Zach Lowe?
Oh, no, of course you didn't. I can't say how I heard, but it wasn't you. And I it's not like I know Gordon well. I've interviewed him 5-6 times. I know some of the people around him. But I had a lot of, that conversation was uncomfortable, but it was very respectful between the two of us. Just again, to go inside baseball a little bit, I asked him about that on the side while I was in Utah, and he was like, man, how do you know that? And I was like, I just do. And he was like, well, do you have to write that? And I was like, well, you know, I mean, I don't have to, but it's Kobe. Like, Kobe is just, it's just one of, it's like catnip. People just want to hear about Kobe. Whatever Kobe does, people want to do it. And he's like, yeah, I'm just going to have to answer a lot of questions about it, you know, and it's just going to be a thing. And I didn't know, maybe it was because Jazz fans hate Kobe and that might be part of it. I don't know. You can give some insight to that. But I told him, like, all right, you know, look, I know it. I knew it before I interviewed you. And he was so professional about it. He was like, you know what? You did. You knew it before. You knew it before you talked to me. And it's your decision, and I'm going to be okay with whatever you do. I'm not going to tell you not to do it. It's your job, and I respect it, and I respect that you have a job to do, and I'm not going to hate you if you do it. I'm not going to never talk to you again, like I understand. And I did it, and it blew over fast. It wasn't a big deal in the end.
You did a nice job in your story on Gordon and the Jazz. I think what Gordon did in the offseason is one of the most interesting stories that's out there. And that is, he went into our coaching staff, Johnny Bryant predominantly, and Isaiah Wright, our strength and conditioning coach, and basically said, where I am is not acceptable. This is a guy who was averaging 20 points, 4 or 5 rebounds, 2 or 3 assists, just had a max contract. And if he didn't change in one iota, he was going to get maxed out again. But he walked into them in the offseason and said, where I am is completely unacceptable. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, I want to be an all-star and I want to make the playoffs. And they said, well, the playoffs is a team thing and the offseason we'll work on that. And then they said, well, what's going to take it to be an all-star? And he was like, I'm going to have to average 22 points and 5 rebounds and 4 assists. And then they started breaking it down like you would a tree and said, all right, well, if you're going to go from 20 to 22 points, you're going to have to get better handle in the paint. And if you're going to get a better handle in the paint, you're going to have quicker hands. If you're going to have quicker hands than Fridays, we're doing boxing. And if you're going to get 22 points a game, you're going to have to start going over your left shoulder because you don't like to go left shoulder. So if you're going to go left shoulder, you got to do these balancing drills. If you're going to do these balancing drills, then you've got to do these drills. And they broke this down to every aspect of his game. And he was in the gym at 7 a.m. every morning. For a brief period, they moved it to 8. And then he started running into the guys that were coming in at 10 and 10:30. He was like, let's go back to 7. And he was in with Johnny Bryant and Isaiah Wright every single day at 7 a.m. They would do lifting, then they would do on court, and then they would do more lifting or boxing or swimming or whatever the extra work is. To me, it's the ultimate example of what makes greatness in the NBA. You're already incredible, and you decide it's not good enough.
No, he's been great in this series. And as you mentioned before, sort of the biggest question in the series. Let's on a very simple level, the Jazz have won this series so far with Joe Johnson at power forward. Joe Johnson on the court plus 17, Joe Johnson off the court minus 17 for our wonderful net zero. And Favors has, you know, Favors, who started the first part of the series and played a lot of center in big lineups with Diaw, is almost the exact same but inverse. The question that the Clippers face, of course, now that when Hayward came back, was, okay, you have Hayward and you have Joe Johnson. They're going to be on the floor together. They're big wings, particularly Joe Johnson is a bruising isolation scorer, as we've seen. Luke Bamute can only guard one of them. Who guards the other one? And I think Quinn did a really good job in Game 5 of sort of forcing the Clippers' hand. He went small earlier. He yanked D out earlier, played him only 13 minutes or something, and went Joe at the four for almost the whole second half and said, okay, answer this question. Who's going to do it? And the answer was sometimes Austin Rivers guarded Gordon Hayward, and sometimes Chris Paul guarded Gordon Hayward. And my God, is Chris Paul good at that considering the size disadvantage? But I just think that's a very tricky question for the Clippers, and I'm interested how they answer it in game six. And I'm interested just who they start. Like, I'm still kind of torn about the decision to start Paul Pierce in the second half of game five.
So there's two, you know, everything's about matchups by the time you hit game six. The Jazz are still struggling with how to deal with the high pick and roll of Chris Paul and DeAndre Jordan, because generally most of the world has struggled with that for the last 5 years. They're struggling. They haven't stopped as good a defender as Bamute is, and he deserves all the credit. But Gordon's dropped 40 and 27 on him in the last two games. So let the Gordon's not
and,
been
and cute. He spent probably more of game five on Joe Johnson than he did on Gordon,
right,
or at least an even split.
So, and they were doubling Joe Johnson pretty hard off those picks, which gave the Jazz the 41 uncontested looks, which is where you and I both had that feeling that, boy, if they get some of those looks, and those do go in at home more than they go in at the road, on the road. That's a funny thing, but same hoop, same everything, but it goes, those go in more at home. And if they go in that building, it's going to be nuts. I think Austin Rivers is going to match Joe Johnson's minutes as much as Doc Rivers can, or whatever his minute limitations are. And so then Austin Rivers guards Gordon Hayward and Bamute guards Joe Johnson.
I think you got to ride with that, right? I mean, I don't think the Clippers really have another great answer. Like Paul Pierce is on the floor. They're actually plus with Paul Pierce on the floor kind of substantially for the series. But if he's on the floor against Utah's best lineups, they're just going to hunt him down and make him go through all sorts of pick and roll machinations and just slice him up.
Didn't the Paul Pierce experiment end when Quinn Snyder just took Boris Diaw one-on-one on Paul Pierce and scored on two straight
possessions? That was very interesting, by the way. Again, Quinn has coached a good series, and as soon as he saw that matchup at the start of the third quarter when Pierce started over Spates, which is a move I didn't like, and I can't really explain why I didn't like it, but that was one reason. Boris came alive a little bit and went down into the post and I think got a basket and a foul right away.
And, you know, Boris keeps that ball. Quinn's big belief, and you can see that game five was a good example, because I think we had six guys with two or more assists. Quinn Snyder's big belief is that when people touch the basketball, they play defense. And it's part of the reason why we live in the final seven, they live in the final 7 seconds of the shot clock so much, is there's just a belief that if everyone's touching and everyone's moving and everyone's involved, they'll play a little defense. Boris facilitates that beautifully. Boris starting doesn't make a lot of sense to people until you kind of notice how much he moves the ball and gets everybody involved. And then in that circumstance, he was even productive because of being guarded by Paul Pierce. The other thing back to what we're talking about, and this really gets into kind of the trick box that Doc Rivers is caught in this series, is if Bamute is guarding Joe Johnson, that's fine, but then Joe Johnson doesn't have to play defense.
Although although part of the reason the Clippers won a couple games in this series is they kind of lost track of Bamute. He's got at least two double-digit scoring games in this series, and they've done a good job moving him around and sort of taking advantage of the fact that they're not guarding him, if that makes it. Like, if it's kind of like Tony Allen. If Tony Allen gets 12 or 13 random points, the Grizzlies historically have been in pretty good shape. It's kind of been the same thing in this series.
Bamute is 2 of his last 13. In game 3 when they won, he was 6 of 9.
He only has one double-digit scoring game. I'm forgetting.
Yeah.
Not two. But
so,
they were mad.
I
know Utah was mad about that game, about
right.
We lost track of him. Oh, of
but
course.
Aren't you willing to ride that if you're the Jazz and – so if Bamute is the guy who gets you, then you tip your hat and you move to Los Angeles for a 1 o'clock game on ABC.
Of course, yeah. If Bamute beats you, although he shot 40% plus from the corner this year, but if he beats you, he beats you, and you know, and if JJ Redick doesn't beat you, and JJ came alive thanks to a lot of free throws in game five, but they've generally sort of vaporized him from this series. then, you know, if Luke beat you instead of JJ and DJ or whatever, then yeah, you tip your cap and move on.
We didn't answer the other question. Don't they start Raymond Felton?
Well, I don't know. Well, I mean, so Raymond Felton over Spates?
Yeah, did you see the Doc quote yesterday, which I think is dead on, and I think Doc is absolutely nailed this, about how tired Chris Paul is?
I did not.
And so Doc says the other day, let me see if I – give me 30 seconds, I'll have it. Doc Rivers' quote after the game or yesterday at practice, I have a dilemma. Without Blake in the first 7 minutes, Chris is the only ball handler on the floor. That's too hard. They started out well. I thought Chris got tired early, so we're going to have to try to do something about that. Either put a guard in early. I thought Austin's minutes on Hayward were phenomenal. That's why I think he'll match Joe Johnson. He's got, what, 16 minutes? So you can't do that. Other than that, it's just Luke. And we don't want to wear him out. So it's a tough call for us. But we have to do something there. I think that hurt our offense, the fact that Chris had to bring it up literally every time. So we have to make an adjustment there. This is where there's a lot there to chew on. But this is where they miss Blake. Blake Griffin was 11 for 11 in the first 9 seconds of the shot clock in this series.
Yeah, the pace that – I mean, the Clippers want to push this pace and get the Jazz out of their comfort zone, and they just haven't been able to do that. And Blake is, you know, Blake rebound and go, or Blake, you know, one hit ahead to Blake and he goes. I mean, that's one of their vehicles for pushing the pace. So Felton has had a nice series for them. I could see that. You know, then that opens up Boris Diaw's post-ups like we talked about. But, you know, again, you got to live with something. You know, I guess the other option is Jamal, but, you know, he's such a sort of quintessential bench player that would be a dramatic move for them. And you know, he had one crazy game in this series and has otherwise been just, you know, okay.
Don't they have to avoid Jamal Crawford and J.J. Redick on the floor as much as possible together?
I mean, this has been an issue for 5 years with the Clippers. They don't have answers on the wing that are – although I think they've made the correct decision. Like, Mabute is playing 35 minutes a game in the series, and I think that's been a correct and essential choice. But, yeah, I mean, look, Crawford has hurt them defensively but helped them offensively, which is the trade-off that you make with him. And if he's out there against their best lineups, they're clearly going to target him every single time, like they did in Game 4 when Joe Johnson scored 9,000 points in a row in the fourth quarter.
This is what's impressive to me about what Quinn's done in this series, is that Doc Rivers has a roster that does, as the phrase I use, put him in a little bit of a trick box. And Quinn is going at every single one of them. Quinn is – every time Doc has a minor weakness out on the floor, which he just – without Blake, he has. That's not his fault. That's just the roster he has as
well,
a coach.
Well, it is his fault. Hold on.
Right.
He had Joe Ingles, as we talked about. He waived Joe Ingles, and Joe Ingles is having quite a time in this year. When Chris Paul did like the angry or sort of like let's get going high bounce off the floor and almost lost the ball when Joe Ingles was nearby him. Do you remember that in Game 5?
Yes.
Joe almost got it, and then they went back to the other end, and Joe was laughing the whole time. It's like that's Joe Ingles.
Chris Paul had eerily reminiscent to Game 5 Oklahoma City meltdown against us on Game 5 the other night.
Really? Yeah, was that bad? Well, I mean, he was also their only offense.
Right, no, but that ball bounce was really kind of strange, right? And
that
kind of goes.
That was weird.
He had that weird turnover against Oklahoma City in Game 5 of 2014. And then, if I remember correctly, he had that weird technical, and he should have gotten tacked for shoving Gordon Hayward. And Scott Foster and Ron Gerritsen bailed Chris Paul out of a disastrous mistake when they had that little scrum for the ball and he either pushed, shoved, punched him in the back and Gordon's walking away and they gave a dual technical foul. Was unless Gordon got the technical foul for dropping a special word, which maybe he did, but I thought was, for being down four, I thought that was down three at the time. I thought that was not a heady play as we think of Chris Paul. In that. But I think you wrote, you know, this kind of goes back to some of the stuff you wrote. What Quinn has created here, and Dennis Lindsay with his help, is they have four, five pick-and-roll ball handlers, right? George Hill, Gordon Hayward, Rodney Hood, Joe Ingles, and Joe Johnson. And so no matter what little weakness is out on the floor, Quinn's going at it in some capacity with those five different guys that can handle the ball either off a pick-and-roll or off a peel or off something and getting the matchup he wants so often and then – you know, letting Joe Johnson do what he needs to do when he gets the right matchup in his time frame.
Joe Johnson, I just It's just ridiculous. I mean, it's just completely ridiculous. It's ridiculous how dependent they are on him, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Like they're only depending on him because he's making every shot. And so if he makes every shot, why would you call any other play? But I don't think when they signed Joe Johnson, my reaction was that's smart. He'll play some small ball four for them, maybe spot some minutes at the three, make some shots, veteran experience. I didn't think it would be Joe Johnson would literally be the most important player in a playoff series and the only crunch time option because of how good he's. I just didn't think it was going to be like this.
Until I saw him, I agreed with you completely. Until I saw him, it was either in late September in open gym or early October in training camp, and he was the second best player on the team. Like, it was obvious. Like, they'd get out on the floor. Gordon Hayward was the best player. I mean, Rudy at this point was – I think I'm talking more offensively and kind of in that open gym setting. You can't tell on a Rudy. He was just great. And then to spend the year with him is – I mean, he's incredible. We're in Detroit on the first game of a road trip, and he is so regimented that he's going to a 6 a.m. Bikram yoga class. That's 4 a.m. body clock time, but that's what he does. And now he's this quiet guy who suddenly kind of almost is a Pied Piper. And so assistant coach Antonio Lang and Johnny Bryan are suddenly with him, and Shelvin Mack's following him. And all of a sudden there's this whole group of six guys that are going to yoga because Joe Johnson's going to Bikram yoga. And I tell you, he's so just kind of got an aura about him. We both stopped at the same convenience store when we flew in the other night at 2 a.m. in the morning. I expected the doors just open, right? Like, I didn't think Joe Johnson actually had to open a door. I thought doors just opened for him. Like, he's incredible to be around every
day. I thought you meant, like, the automatic doors would
slide
open.
No, automatic door. He doesn't need automatic doors. He's Joe Johnson. He's just got an aura to him.
It sounds like you're talking about Joe Jesus, and he just walks right up to a door that's not automatic, and he either walks through it or it opens automatically.
That's what I expected.
He's 8 for what? First of all, which yoga is Bikram yoga?
That's the hot yoga.
That sounds miserable.
I agree.
Do people die doing that?
They should. I do yoga, as you know, and you said you will not do it. We've had this brief discussion on the floor at Vivint Smart Home Arena. I do yoga on the. I've never done it publicly in my life. I do it on the road, in my room, so that nobody can ever see how ridiculous I look. But I think the idea of hot yoga is just awful.
I don't even like sitting in saunas.
Right.
Not that I have a lot of opportunity in my life.
I
probably sat in four saunas in my whole life.
Just became 65 years old,
or whatever. Like maybe four in my life I've ever sat in a sauna, and I'm like, it's just really hot, and I can't breathe like really that. Well, why am I in here? This isn't nice.
You're gonna go take a steam shower with our other 65-year-old Kevin Arnovitz.
He's an old soul. What were we talking about? Joe Johnson. Joe Johnson in the last 5 minutes of close games in this series. Defined as score within five, is 8 of 10 from the floor. Joe Johnson in the last 3 minutes of games that where the score is within three or less is 4 of 4 from the floor. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And he's doing it over good defense. Like, I'm not even sure what you're supposed to do. When they double him, Rodney Hood hits an open three. There's just nothing to do. He's just making crazy shots.
Well, and I think the thing that's not known about Joe Johnson, I believe his career high assists in a game is like 17. Like, this is not a guy who's an unwilling passer. So when he catches it at the free throw line and starts to work you down in the middle of the floor, and he can see all four other players, and one of them's Rudy Gobert, who's going to the rim, and the other three all shoot 39% or better from three, I don't know what you're supposed to do defensively.
Gobert looks great, by the way. How close to 100% do you think he is?
He's an incredible fighter. I mean, his quest for greatness is very high. That's why he's as good as he is. So whether he's 100% or not, I think he's going to play at that level, if that makes sense. He was really injured in the second half of last season. That MCL was really causing him problems. It's why I've been kind of not as high on the belief that Durant's going to be okay, because I watched Gobert kind of go through one day being good and the next day not being good. And, I think the calf strain might have been really, frankly, a blessing for Durant in some ways that he got more rest, because last year, one day Rudy looked good and the next day he just couldn't set that leg and believe in it. This year, just having him at full strength, he looks great. I agree. But Chris Paul is Chris Paul. So when he's dropping on that pick and roll, Chris Paul makes him look as uncomfortable as anyone in the league makes Rudy Gobert look.
But Gobert has – Chris Paul is not walking into 18-foot jumpers in this series, which he's one of the few players in the league who, if he can walk into open mid-range shots, that's a great, great shot. And it looks at times like he has the space to do that, but I don't know if Rudy is just so long that I'm sort of underestimating how big that space is or what it looks like to Chris Paul, because he's not it's not like he's just raining 18 footers and that's the way that the Clippers could win. Like, Rudy is doing enough, whatever he's doing, it's enough to just Chris Paul has to work harder than that.
The angle right kind of snake forced to his left hand, as most teams do, because Chris Paul passes predominantly with his right hand, so people like to force him left because then he can't pass quite as well, and then he snakes it back underneath to the mid-range right side of key fading back jumper. He's one of eight on that shot in the series, so you're absolutely right. What I'm seeing out of Chris Paul is he has to – I'm calling him the fisherman a little bit. He has to reel the games back in without Blake, without any other help. And the Jazz have had these fairly good starts or these fairly good quarters, and he remarkably, because he's just so awesome – brings the Clippers back. Like, the Jazz went up 11 in the fourth, and then he makes two shots. He is exerting so much energy in those little 3 and 5 play sequences where he wills that team from down 6 to back to tied, and I think it's exhausting him. The incredible number on him right now, and I have updated it. He's taken two times more shots in the second half than the first half of this series. And he's taking – this is not updated. This does not have game five. But prior to game five, in 70 minutes when leading, he took 32 shots. So, you know, about one every 2.5 minutes. When trailing, he took 38 shots in 65 minutes. So he's shooting one about every minute and a half when he's trailing. He's shooting 50 – going into that game, he's shooting 58%. He's really having to will the Clippers back into these games on a regular basis.
And by the way, guarding a good player on every single defensive possession, including a bunch on Hayward, where he gives up, you know, 6-7 inches at least, and a lot of weight. And Gordon, other than a couple of shots here or there, hasn't really been able to exploit that. And even when he does quote-unquote exploit it, they're tough shots. Like, that's not a matchup that the Jazz are milking. They're not going to it. Part of that is just because they're going to Joe Johnson and it's working. But that Chris Paul has held up, not surprisingly, he's one of the greatest defensive players at his position ever, but he's held up well in that matchup.
You mentioned that earlier. I'm curious. I hadn't thought so much about just sticking Chris Paul on Gordon, but that burden is just...
No, you can't. It's just too much. You can do it for... That's why we'll see it in the fourth quarter or whenever the lineups dictate. Like, if Austin Rivers isn't on the floor, and Austin was bad offensively in game five, and I don't think looks 100%. You know, whatever the matchups are, if they need to, that's what they'll do late, and it's a lot. We'll be right back with more from David Locke, the radio voice of the Utah Jazz. Speaking of matchups, one thing that I really like, these are the little things that, like, you notice in the playoffs and they become important. I think Quinn was really smart starting games with Hayward guarding Spates and Diaw guarding Mbamute for two reasons. Number one, if you can put a wing player on a stretch five, that's always smart because they just track them better. Number two, it's the opposite matchup that the Clippers want when they're on defense, and the Jazz got two or three buckets because the Clippers couldn't find that matchup. Gordon got an open three when Spates was stuck on him and couldn't follow him around, and then someone posted up Redick. I can't remember. I thought it still looks like I don't think they're doing that to create that cross match confusion, but I think they know it's sort of a ripple effect benefit of it.
I think this is where Quinn's really special. Okay, so Blake Griffin's out. Maybe he's not. Maybe this is regular for most people. Quinn is special. I'm around him every day. I got a front row seat. I'm really, really fortunate to have the view I have of watching the detail they go through.
He also got a playoff haircut, by the way. He's looking sharp.
We had big haircut day in Utah. You know, all the fans came and either got the Hayward or the Gobert. It was a big day around here. It's crazy.
What is the proper name for what Gobert has? It looks like a lightning bolt kind of to me shaved in there. I don't know what it is, though.
We went with the Harry Potter. He didn't like that.
He's very picky about things like that, like what his nickname should be, and you know, he doesn't like certain nicknames. Anyway, so you're talking about Quinn.
Yes.
I'm sorry,
I figure since his license plate holder is his license plate is Godzilla, that I'm.
I told him that. That's the worst one. That's the worst of all the Rudy Gobert. Godzilla It's not bad. It's just the other ones are awesome.
They are. French Connection, Stifle Tower. Shout out to Jody. So the – I where were we? On
Quinn,
that matchup, I think – you know, I think that is – I think that's where Quinn just in his staff second-level stuff, right? So Blake Griffin's out, and that's their adjustment. Their adjustment is exactly what you talked about, is that they're now inverting who's guarding the small forward and power forward. It allows them to do things on both the offense and the defensive side that they weren't allowed to do and that have been successful so far in the series. The other one that I love, and I'd actually be curious your thoughts, Zach, how much stuff Quinn and his staff predetermine. And maybe everyone does this, but for example, like they just the, like, let's take something simple like the get in play, right? So late in the game, you just got, they have pre-decided before the night starts all of those type of things so that when the, it's happening and there's a million other things taking place, that that decision has already been made. Does every team do that?
Probably a lot of them, but I don't know the degree. I don't know the degree, but it's you know, they are a very prepared staff in Utah.
Right. It's pretty incredible. Let me ask you another question.
Okay.
This has been my most interesting thing of the season, and it's really, it has monumental impact on what happens in the offseason. So it's the Gordon Hayward, Jimmy Butler, Paul George concept of who of these three is better. And I've had some interesting comments with people in the league about it. And the two most interesting I had was one person said to me, well, everyone thinks that George and Butler are better because they might be better in the last 2 minutes and Gordon's better for the first 46. I thought that was an interesting perspective. The other one that someone said is, what I love most about Gordon is he doesn't hijack possessions from his teammates. He never takes a shot that isn't right, where Butler and George just go a certain amount of time where they have to shoot. What's your thoughts on that whole, those two thoughts, and what's your thought on that whole, who's better of that three group? And then it obviously impacts who gets, you know, one of them is going to be all NBA this year, and two of them could make an extra $70 million or whatever it is because of it.
It's become such a fact. I think the Jimmy Butler, because they were available or semi-available via trade, the Jimmy Butler versus Paul George debate became the most interesting debate of the season. Gordon wasn't in it just because he wasn't going to be traded. It wasn't like a hot subject. Gordon has made it close with those two. I think Jimmy Butler had the best season, and I think Paul George is the best player. I still am team Paul George. I just think every...
You're not bothered by the fact that Paul George decided to go for a month run of trying to be the world's worst teammate?
I don't know if he was the world's worst teammate. I don't know what his teammates thought about him. I don't know if they were annoyed by his comments or not annoyed by his comments. But, I mean, Jimmy Butler has had runs of the same – of similar similar exasperation in the Bulls locker room in last season mostly. I just think every year the Pacers get to the playoffs and Paul George is an absolute monster who's gone toe-to-toe with LeBron and his teams have lost every time and it's not his fault. I still think he's the best player. I think he's the best defender of those three when he's locked in, a little bit over Jimmy, although it's close. If I had to order them, I would go George, Butler, Gordon. And I think they're three of the top 15 players in the NBA. I don't think there's any shame in being third of that. But Gordon has made it close and in the playoffs has been as impressive, probably more impressive than Butler and as impressive as George almost.
It's interesting. I mean, I think it's, I don't know. I find it a fascinating debate. I'm obviously biased because I've watched Gordon grow up in front of my eyes, and I like him personally, and I like his wife a great deal. You know, I mean, so I'm not even trying to pretend that I don't have a bias here. But I do think that they were both better than him in years past. I'm not sure I'm convinced of that anymore. I think it's interesting that Gordon's team won, what, 9 more games than either of those two guys won in a much harder conference, that there's a chance if they win a game that Gordon's the one that's still playing. I think it's interesting that Gordon's never had these teammate problems that either of them have had. I think Gordon's a much better defensive player than anyone thinks.
That I agree with, and I don't know. Gordon Hayward, I put him on my honorable mention all defense. He has become a really good defensive player, like really, really good. Gets through screens, fights hard, challenges shots. Doesn't make mistakes. I mean, once every 100 possessions, he'll make a mistake. Everyone does, but like he's a pretty airtight defender. Physical. I totally agree with you. People aren't onto that yet. It actually reminds me of Klay Thompson when Klay Thompson was a good defensive player, like a year before people started to realize he was a good defensive player.
Yeah, it's the tennis background.
I guess
he's just much quicker laterally. I mean, the telling moment of the year was Blake Griffin trying to bump in back Gordon, and you couldn't move, and Blake couldn't move him anymore.
The moment that stuck out for me was when I was in Utah. They played the Kings, and it's just a moment. It's just the Kings. They stink. But Rudy Gay curled off a couple of screens and rose for a jump shot. And against wing players, Rudy Gay is a big, tall, long. He's not used to guys being in his face and bothering his jump shot. And Gordon fought through every pick, and I either deflected it or challenged it so closely that it was like an air ball. And it was right in front of where Press Row is there. And I was like, and I already considered him a good defender, but I started watching him more defensively after that because it was like, it was one of those things that, that was pretty damn good.
And what are you going to do about Joe Ingles? Can he still be a Marc Gasol All-Star?
A Luke Walton All-Star. Please get your fake All-Star
teams. Sorry.
How about we end with talking about the future of the Jazz? Obviously this series might impact some things. Although I'd be interested actually to hear, you can't divulge too much about what you know about Gordon, but have they already done enough, do you think, to convince him this is a place where I can win long-term?
So truthfully, I know nothing. Honestly, I know absolutely nothing. I have not talked to Gordon about it for 1 second, very intentionally. I haven't talked to Robin about it for 1 second. I absolutely know nothing. I think in the last 3 years, what Dennis Lindsay and Quinn Snyder have done for Gordon Hayward, it's exceptional. His growth has been there. The question is, how scarred is he from the first few years? And he didn't like the first few years. He didn't like playing under Tyrone Corbin, and he didn't like the rebuild, and how much what happens in free agency.
I don't think he liked the offer sheet either.
Right. No, absolutely. I think that's fair. That negotiation did not go well. And so I think what the one problem you have when you're the incumbent team in free agency is you're the only one who has scars with your player. Right. So whether it's Danny Ainge or Pat Riley or Magic Johnson or whomever it is that's going to sit across the table from Gordon Hayward and wherever Mark Bartlestein's office in Chicago is they'll have no scars, right? They have never done anything wrong to Gordon Hayward in Gordon's mind. And so that's what I think gets interesting in any free agency is that you have the home team, while on one level has the advantage of being able to sit there and say, look what we've done in our program, and you can see all the growth and everything and what Dennis is building. You also have scars because of the time that you spent no differently than any relationship. I mean, it's probably, we could take this analogy somewhere else. I'd rather not go. But I think that's just the reality of any relationship. So I think that gets interesting in free agencies or in the right to go talk to everyone around the league. He will never have another circumstance like what he has here. Now, does that matter to him? I don't know. But if he stays, it's his town. He will be the third most beloved Jazz player in the history of the franchise. He will have a place here forever, which I think is interesting that none of these players ever consider. But after watching us have our 20th year reunion of the finals team and seeing how many of these guys kind of just don't have any footing on what they're doing with life other than just kind of hanging. I think there's a real value to the fact that you're going to retire at 35 to 40 and you're going to actually have another 35 years of your life, and sitting on the couch is not actually a good answer. And if Gordon stays in Utah, he can have whatever job he wants, be it coach, broadcaster, general manager, financial advisor, whatever he cares to do in life, he will be able to do. So Dennis Lindsay's built a franchise that has embraced the strengths of Utah, which is the fact that it's very family friendly. He's got two kids. It's not a great place if you're 26 years old and single, probably, but it's a pretty darn good place if you're 28 years old and have two kids. Trevor Booker found that. Joe Johnson's finding it right now. I think, there's every reason in the world for him to be lured by Pat Riley banging his rings on the table or deciding he wants to go be back with Brad or Magic Johnson's lure of LA or whatever it might be. But there's no situation that will ever equal for him what he has here. That may not be the deciding factor for him, but this place, he would be king, and it's his franchise. And I think that's hard to bypass, frankly. I mean, I go just late game Washington, two plays, whack, whack, your chest bumping, your boys coming off and have just won a ball game. You're not getting that in other places.
I would predict that he stays. I don't. It's not a prediction I feel confident in. No one can feel confident in it right now. If you're asking me for certainty and whatever, I can't give it to you. But if you asked me, you got to make a prediction now. I would predict that he stays. I do think all those teams you mentioned will be suitors. I think the Clippers will be suitors if things blow up there and they end up with any sort of cap flexibility or sign and trade ability, which they don't really have. Everyone will be. I mean, everyone with max money will be. But I would say he's going to stay. And if he stays and George Hill stays, I think you got to say goodbye to Joe Ingles, my friend. I don't think you can afford Joe Ingles anymore. Joe Ingles has made himself some money.
And I think it's – I don't think there's any question. I'm so happy for Joe. The story's so – I think you've documented the story, but if you don't mind me quickly, it's such an incredible story. Joe Ingles – I think at the time his fiance was one of the great handball players in Australia, is flying from Australia to LA to come and see Joe's NBA debut. The flight from Australia is long enough that Joe gets released by Doc Rivers in that time period. So now Joe meets her at the airport. She's all excited. We're going to see your NBA debut. And he has to say, by the way, we might just be going to Santa Barbara for vacation because I don't have a job, actually. And they go to lunch in LA together and the Jazz call. So he's like, well, actually, honey, we're not actually watching my NBA debut in LA. We're flying to Utah. And I mean, what a turn of events. And now to do this as a restricted free agent, the Jazz are under a money crunch, and what other contracts are they going to be able to move in the offseason to be able to dictate what they're able to do? And, you know, what other players might be able to come that are equally as good in some of those positions you just mentioned for maybe less money. And then you keep Joe Ingles, but no, Joe's made himself an awful lot of money. I'll be very curious to see how he works in another system. I do feel like this one's particularly good for him, and that Quinn Snyder had a vision on how to use him and has used him brilliantly. Don't we have to give the Jazz coaching staff a shout out for good close game finishes after you took so much heat when you were in town?
I didn't understand why that was such a. I went on a radio station in Utah, and after my podcast with Boris Dio, eating my avocado toast that Boris got me.
Nice.
And I just said, and this was in December, so we're not even 30. Are we 30 games into the season? I don't
Maybe
know.
Not.
25, yeah. 30. And I just make some remark about, you know, how, you know, last year they were not good in close games. The offense was not good in close games last year. And that's an issue that, you know, we got to monitor or something going forward. And these texts start coming in from people with the team, like, how could you say that? What did you say? And I'm like, wait, hasn't everyone in Utah been writing about this for like a year? Like, is this some groundbreaking thing? Everything I read about Utah going into the season was, well, they were so-and-so points per possession minus in crunch time last year. And so I say that on the radio, and it's like, what the hell? Like, why is this such a big deal?
They were 20-13 this year in games within 3 points in the final 5 minutes. They were, for a long time, they're the number one offensive team in the league in the clutch play this year.
They've been great, and they've been – I rattled off the Joe Johnson stats earlier. They're winning crunch time in this series, so congratulations to them. Stop yelling at me for things that are true that I said on the radio that are true and were true and remain true. I got to let you go because you got to go to practice. We're going to have you back, especially if they advance, because we didn't get to talk about Dennis Lindsay's comments about NBA officiating, which is an issue that I was going to write about before he beat me to the punch, unfortunately. But I want to talk about that at some point. But we have to see what happens, because if they don't win Game 6, they're going to L.A. in Game 7. If they go to L.A. in Game 7, we might not be talking about the Jazz in
we
5
might
days.
Not.
So we'll see.
All right. I'm excited because I want to go spend time in San Francisco, my hometown. Now, if it means I get a second appearance on the Low Post, I'm really rooting for us to win.
Well, look, David Locke, seriously, I've gone on your podcast before. This guy, for people who, if anyone here doesn't know him, and I would suspect most of my listeners do, one of the best in the business, one of the hardest working guys in the business, has started this entire podcast network where there's a podcast about each team. I mean, it's a pleasure to have you on. You're a grinder. You're one of the very best at what you do. You have personality, charisma. It's an honor to have you on. So
you're very kind, and you know, keep up the amazing work you do. One of the reasons we built the podcast network is because I think it's impossible for national people to cover local teams with expertise. You're probably at the peak of anyone who's able to do that. I find it remarkable that you can go into Milwaukee this year, go into Salt Lake this year, and come out with stories that are in-depth, accurate, and detailed on teams in which you embed yourself for short periods of time. That's an incredibly hard thing to do. It's very easy to do what I'm doing, which is to live with a team for a year and know what's going on.
No, it's not. And it's not easy to do it the way you do it. But anyway, enough mutual love fest. I will hopefully see you down the road. Enjoy Game 6. Enjoy that atmosphere. It sounds like it's going to be great. And thanks for the time.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Zach.